This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Morris Dees, co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The center monitors hate groups, militias, and other extremist anti-government groups that are part of the Patriot Movement. The center has issued a new report on anti-government extremists called False Patriots. And Morris Dees has written a new book about the militia movement called The Gathering Storm. Dees warns that the threat of domestic terrorism has increased sharply since the bombing of Oklahoma City's federal building 1 year ago. You know, the New York Times last Sunday had an article in which it said that efforts to fight domestic terrorism are being supplemented more than ever by private human rights groups that track the fringe right, groups like yours and the Simon Wiesenthal Center. And the article also mentioned that your group uses undercover operatives. What are some of your techniques for monitoring extremist groups?
Well, probably 99 or 95% of the information we get comes from public sources. We do monitor these groups. There are 75 or 80 web pages and internet postings. We get all the material that they publish and analyze it very carefully, recording the names and events of things that are going on. We clip some 13,000 newspapers and publications in this country to get information about them. We get sources from law enforcement. And at times, we use our own people to gather information that we feel that you can't get in these other sources. We never violate anybody's civil rights getting this information. We've been the victim of some violence from these groups, and we primarily do this because we're trying to protect our own selves and our property and our lives.
There have been retaliative acts against you and your group, bomb threats. You were, I think, challenged to a duel by Louis Beam, one of the leaders of the extremist movement. What's the worst thing that actually happened?
Well, I think the worst thing that happened was in 1983, late 83, three Klansmen broke in our building and burned it at Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery. With the help of the FBI and the ATF, we caught them, and one of them was on the board of directors of Louis Beam's Klan group at the time. Possibly this was done in retaliation for us stopping Beam's group down in Texas. We've had a number of rather serious death threats. When Alan Berg was killed, he's a Denver radio talk show host that was killed by one of these groups called The Order out in Denver in 1984. I was told by the FBI, fortunately in advance of that, that my name was at the top of that hit list. And from that date forward, and we've had some pretty serious security.
You suspected 1 year ago that there was going to be a serious anti-government event on April 19th, the anniversary of the end of the Waco siege. Where were you when you actually heard about the bombing of Oklahoma City's federal building?
It was a little more than a year ago I suspected a problem. I wrote the Attorney General 6 months before Oklahoma City, laying out the groups I thought should be watched and the reasons why. I was actually in Pensacola, Florida, taking the deposition of John Burt, who's head of Rescue America. I represent the doctor that was killed there. I just finished my depositions, and I was loading up my stuff early in the morning on the 19th to leave, listening to the squealing sounds of children playing in the swimming pool below, and one of my investigators said, "Turn the television on quickly." I turned it on in the hotel room at the Holiday Inn on the beach and looked at it, and wow, I mean, you know, it's just, you saw people running out with little kids, and I couldn't believe what I heard and what I was watching. It was a horrifying scene.
Outside of the horror of what had happened, what was your first thought politically about what had motivated it?
Well, instantly, I mean, within a matter of a minute, Joe Roy, our chief investigator, walked in and said, because I think the announcer said something about terrorists, Albert looking for terrorists or something from overseas. And he said, they don't need to look overseas. All they need to do is look at some of these patriot groups in this country. I picked up the phone within 10 minutes and called a contact I have in the Justice Department and suggested that they look closer to home.
I'm wondering if before the bombing of the federal building, if you were often criticized for almost giving credibility to extremist groups by taking them so seriously and by thinking of them as a threat instead of a nuisance, you know, a few really extremist people who don't, in fact, have any power.
Well, Terry, we have had that criticism, especially when we started Klan Watch in 1980. You know, why talk about the Klan? They'll simply just go away, don't give them publicity. And it turned out shortly after that, we had a lot of Klan crimes, a lynching by a Klan group, and it proved that what we was working on did have some merit. As far as this Patriot movement, we get some criticism from those on the right, especially religious fundamentalists, who say, look, you're lumping all these people together. You're saying the Patriot movement or the so-called Patriot movement in this country involves, you know, conservative Christian people, and that you shouldn't lump us together. And I agree that if that's what they interpret we're doing, we're not doing, because I think there are many good fundamentalist Christians in this country who are not for this. And also, a large number of people in the militia are good people. They simply are frustrated with government and join these groups for any number of reasons. What they don't realize is that the ones pulling the strings behind the scene here are people with a dangerous agenda.
Your group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, has issued a new report called False Patriots, The Threat of Anti-Government Extremists. One of the people you sent the report to is Attorney General Janet Reno. You have a lot of recommendations that you conclude your report with. What are some of the things you would like to see the government do to crack down on extremist groups, things that go beyond what the terrorism bill includes?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the terrorism bill really that make much difference with domestic terrorism, especially that thing that rushes along death penalty appeals. I mean, terrorists don't get on death row, and that's not going to deter them one way or the other. That's a political move. First of all, we want the Attorney General and the state's Attorney Generals, all 50, to set up a joint domestic terroristing task force to monitor domestic terrorism in this country. And that means gathering intelligence lawfully within the bounds of the Constitution. But when a group says, in effect, what they intend to do, that they intend to use violence to get across their views, then under the Attorney General's guidelines, those groups can be monitored without violating any rules. Also, information should be shared from the ground up. A lot of local law enforcement people are in a much better position to know what is happening in their communities, but they may not know what they're looking at. So we need to have some education as to what domestic terrorism is all about, the type of people involved, the kind of things they do. The public in this country needs to be educated and prepared concerning the question and the subject of domestic terrorism. Beyond what we asked the Attorney General to do last week, I would also like to see states enforce the anti-militia laws that they have on their books. 24 states have laws that strictly prohibit private armies. Second Amendment does not allow private armies. It allows a well-regulated militia, and that regulated militia has been held by the Supreme Court time again, to be the National Guard. States have these laws on the books. I've been a part of enforcing them in two states, Texas and North Carolina, and in Alabama, three states actually, and courts ruled that those militia groups had to be disbanded in those particular states.
How many militias do you estimate exist now?
Well, we've added up all the numbers we have had, and we've seen there, and we come up with 411 militia groups in the country. Some of them may have disbanded since we started counting them a year ago, and there may have been new ones that popped up. They don't record their businesses like the Chamber of Commerce, so it's hard to keep up with them. I think that's a pretty reliable count. We count a militia group, and Michigan is a militia group, but it might have 50 smaller militia groups within it. So each one of those counts as a separate militia group. But what most people don't realize is that militia groups aren't just restricted to Montana and the Great Plains. They're in Florida, Texas, Alabama, North Carolina, and Connecticut, New York, and Oregon. They're all over the United States, especially those groups that don't necessarily call themselves militias, and the most dangerous ones don't. In Minnesota, you have the Minnesota Patriots Council, and that was a group that was caught last year with a plot to poison federal workers in a federal building through the water system. And in Virginia, a group calling itself the Hunt Club, Virginia Hunt Club, was caught with a plot to steal explosives from an armory. So most of these groups don't call themselves militias like you see on television. They have a lot of different names.
Morris Dees is my guest. He's the co-founder of the Southern Law Poverty Center, a group that, among other things, monitors extremist groups in America. And their group has just issued a new report called False Patriots, The Threat of Anti-Government Extremists. And Morris Dees also has a new book called Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Morris Dees, co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors extremist groups in America. When the hate groups, the anti-Semitic and racist groups, came together with the militias, did you get more worried? Did that combination signify more trouble than you thought we were in before?
Yes, it did. In fact, that's when we set up our militia task force in the summer in August of 1994. And in October of 94, I was so alarmed by the mixture of these so-called militia groups with well-known neo-Nazis and racists. That's when I wrote Attorney General Reno a letter, sending her a list of the groups that we knew, the people involved in them, and the history of their criminal activity, and suggested that this combination of hate groups with those who have a background of violence is a real recipe for disaster, and I encourage them to alert the federal agencies around the country.
What do you think encouraged the leaders of hate groups to link up with the leaders of militias?
Actually, I think that leaders of hate groups have always been stymied by the small number of people they could appeal to when they talked against the Jews and condemned blacks. In other words, when they were racist. A lot of people in this country just don't like to be associated with that. They had a hardcore group of people, but unlike in the civil rights days of the South when the Klan was large, those times have passed, and they were falling on hard times. But when they saw Randy Weaver, his wife and child, be killed, and when they saw the gun bills pass, the Brady Bill, and then the handgun waiting bill, and then the terrorist bill, these people, like Louis Beam and William Pierce and Reverend Pete Peters, the Christian Identity, saw a great opportunity to expand their movement. And that's when they call all these people in.
I believe that Louis Beam, one of the people who you describe as a leader of the extremist movement in America, once challenged you to a duel. Would you tell us what happened?
Well, I had taken him to court and rather embarrassed him. He had the Texas Emergency Reserve. He just got back from Vietnam, been a helicopter gunner. And the Vietnamese fishermen in Galveston Bay were besieged by American fishermen who wanted him out. These Vietnamese fishermen worked hard, and they showed up, the Americans. And so they called the Klan in, and the Klan, whether they burned the boats or not, some boats were burned. I went down to represent the Vietnamese fishermen, and in the process got an injunction stopping the Klan from harassing these fishermen, and also joined with the Attorney General of Texas in enforcing Texas's anti-militia law. And a federal court enjoined Louis Beam from operating his Texas Emergency Reserve. He had big plans for having an army in Texas, and they trained with some active duty military, and they trained with uniforms and, you know, military-type weapons in five separate secret camps in the state that we learned about. Well, being embarrassed, Beam left the state and went to the Aryan Nations and became a kind of an ambassador at large up there at the Aryan Nations and going around preaching their philosophy. And he wrote me a letter when the postmark was on Aryan Nations stationery, challenging me to a duel to the death. You know, we both go into the woods and you know, you choose your weapon, and the one that I guess is alive and standing comes out. Well, I wouldn't, you know, honor such a ridiculous thing. I decided that, you know, I'd fight my battles with him in court.
Oh, did he agree to keep it that way?
Well, you know, I hadn't been face-to-face with him since I took his deposition, and he looked at me and he said I was an Antichrist Jew, and that no Antichrist Jew could tell an Aryan soldier or Christian what to do in this country. Unfortunate for him, the judge was a black woman, and I think she gave the Klan their due justice in court that time.
I'm wondering how much direct one-on-one contact you've had with members of extremist groups, and if you've tried to have conversations with any of them, just kind of coolly describing what you think is wrong with their conspiracy theories and ideology and trying to logically explain why you don't think that really holds up under scrutiny.
I've had a lot of conversations with these people. I grew up with Klan people in the South when I days in the 40s and the 50s when I grew up on a small cotton farm, and I think I know the thinking of these people. I don't think it'd do you much good to talk to Lewis Beam or Pete Peters. They are committed zealots. But in most of the cases that we've won at the Southern Poverty Law Center representing people against these groups, our star witnesses have been former members of their groups. In most cases, people that we convinced that they ought to testify for us. And we had nothing to hold over their head. It wasn't a criminal prosecution. These individuals like Beam and others have tremendous leadership ability. And I've tried to appeal to them that they ought to use this ability to get people to care about each other, to love each other, instead of hate each other. I think that it's hard to say what motivates these people. It varies. Some of the young skinheads today are motivated because of they've been losers in life. They have low self-esteem. They come from dysfunctional families. And leaders like Tom Metzger of the White Aryan Resistance, who appeals to skinheads, is looked upon in many ways as a father figure. One of his national vice presidents for organization, young Dave Mazzella, testified for us in a case on the witness stand that Metzger taught him to encourage violence and that he would do anything for Metzger, even kill for him, in order to keep his acceptance. This young Dave Mazzella did encourage three skinheads to do violence, and they killed a black man up in Portland, Oregon. I represented his family in a suit against Metzger.
What are some of the current conspiracy theories that you find either most absurd or most alarming that are circulating?
Well, obviously, the most absurd are the ones that guys like Lewis Beam laugh at, because Beam, you know, doesn't have these big conspiracy theories. He and the Christian Identity people, like the Trockmans. Trockmans see black helicopters on the horizon, and they say that's, you know, that those are Russian helicopters. They say there are, you know, 100,000 Chinese troops stationed in salt mines in different parts of the country, and the government's building concentration camps. And they, like Timothy McVeigh, supposedly told people they plant microchips in your body so they can keep up with you. These are absurd conspiracy theories. And I don't think, though, quite frankly, that that's what's motivating the true hardcore neo-Nazis and racists that are part of this patriot movement.
What is?
It's a belief, a strong belief, that the Aryan race is near the end of its line in the United States and in the world, and there's a giant Jewish conspiracy out to make sure that happens. They intend to do it through polluting the genes of the Aryan race through mixing with blacks, and they see the blacks as the Freeman said in that speech that was recorded about a week before the standoff, that the Jews brought the blacks in this country to use them to tear down the white race. Now, that may certainly be a conspiracy theory. I'm not saying it's not. But that's their bottom line, hardcore belief, and that's what this battle is all about.
Morris Dees, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Morris Dees is the co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama. Its new report on anti-government extremists is called False Patriots. Dees' new book is called Gathering Storm, America's Militia Threat. This is Fresh Air.